What's up, everybody? We are back. Necromaniacs podcast has returned. This is our, I guess, Christmassy end of the year edition. Our last one was back at the end of October, which was a really good one, I thought. We had Rich O'Brien, Darkseid, hanging out with us, but tonight it's just me and Mr. Hill.
This is our Happy Holidays you know, episode, which I take offense to Happy Holidays. You know what I mean?
Yes.
What happens to say, I mean, regardless of what your, you know, trip is, mm-hmm. what's wrong with saying Merry Christmas to people?
I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I mean, I even heard Jewish people say that they don't even care. It's fine, Merry Christmas. Like, nobody, like, it's not a big deal. I have yet to meet a human being that thinks it is a big deal in the negative to say that. I mean, I know they're out there somewhere.
Yeah, they're
apparently
definitely out there.
I've yet to personally meet one in my entire life that is offended by those two words. It's kind of weird, right?
Yeah, it's like this whole culturally insensitive like vibe that seems to be the big thing these days. I feel like people just need to calm down a little bit.
You know? Totally. But yeah, I mean, it's you know, come on. Everybody calm down. Anyway, there's our political moment of the day. Right, socio-political moment of the night. But tonight we are going to talk about three movies, one of which is the Austrian film Goodnight Mommy. We're going to talk about the brand new American Western slash horror film Bone Tomahawk. And then we are going to pick one holiday movie, holiday horror movie, of course. And we decided to go with the 2012 nasty little number, Silent Night. But we're going to kick it off with Good Night, Mommy. Good Night, Mommy came out in 2014 in Austria, written by Veronica France and Severin Fiali. It was selected as the Austrian entry for Best Foreign Language Film at the last Academy Awards, actually, but it was not nominated. So I guess it was close, but no cigar. That would have been pretty cool to see that.
But it did win a bunch of European awards.
Yes, it did, actually. It did phenomenal business, too, over in Germany and Austria as well. Right off the top, this movie got a lot of buzz based on the trailer, Mike. It was kind of like all over the place about 2-3 months ago, I remember, on Facebook. And the YouTube trailer got a ton of hits. Do you remember that?
Absolutely. The trailer immediately made me want to see the movie.
Yeah.
Because I saw this and, you know, you see there's images of a woman with blonde hair and her face bandaged. And these two young kids. And
and it's just creep city. The woman looks creepy. The little boys look creepy. The whole kind of vibe to it definitely was like, yeah, we need to see this. And then the word of mouth from the film festival reviews was these amazing reviews, nightmare fuel and this and that. But now it has landed on American DVD and Blu-ray. It came out December 1st, you know, a few weeks back. Not on Netflix, but it is available on Amazon and iTunes as a rental or download. I caught it on Amazon. It's a small cast. Basically, the mother's played by Suzanne West and Wiest, and the two brothers, Elias and Lucas, are played by twins, Elias Schwartz and Lucas Schwartz. So that's interesting. They have the same names.
They look identical too.
Yeah, they really do. Kind of interesting. But I'm just going to give a brief little plot summary of it here. After undergoing cosmetic facial surgery, a mother, we don't get the name, by the way, comes back, initially at least, comes back to her modern, this beautiful, isolated lakeside home to her 10-year-old twins, Elias and Lucas. She's covered in bandages with only her eyes and mouth visible. The twins are unnerved with their mother's appearance and are further taken aback when she begins to exhibit strange behavior. Though it is the middle of the summer, the mother orders the twins to keep the blinds closed during the day and imposes a strict rule of silence throughout the house, allows them only to play outdoors. And the mother seemingly is like a crueler, different version of the mother that they know and love.
Yeah, they claim that somebody took their mother and they believe her to be an imposter. Mm. That's like the vibe that, you know, the kids kind of put out there.
And basically, she kind of gets really angry with them easily and gets physical with them. But according to these two boys in their conversations with each other, who is this? You know, this isn't our mom. She would never act like this, you know? They begin to suspect that underneath the bandages, this may not be the same person at all. Their doubts are confirmed when they find an old picture that shows the mother with another unknown woman wearing identical clothes and sharing similar physical traits. With the suspicion that the woman, that woman is residing in the house as an imposter, the twins, well, they manage to kind of subdue the mom, tie her to the bed, and basically demand to know where their real mother is. And, well, from there, basically, the movie delves into its really kind of deep, dark recesses where they basically start to torture their own mother. Or who they think, well, I can't say it's their mother because they are convinced it is not their mother. They literally end up, at one point, taping her mouth shut to going on later in the film to using crazy glue on the mouth of this woman who may or may not be their mother to you know, sew her mouth shut. There are a lot of really jarring scenes in this movie. Yeah. The twins, for some reason, collect, are they roaches? Yeah, I don't know what, like, these bugs are. They're
hissing cockroaches.
They collect, they have a huge aquarium thing filled with hissing cockroaches. They are the oddest boys ever. It's funny, at one point when the movie started, I wasn't even sure if it was taking place in the modern era until that we kind of saw the usage of cell phones and some modern technology. Initially, you're kind of, you don't know what the hell's going on actually with the movie. Would you agree? Like,
yeah, it's sort of like a timeless vibe to it because there's nothing in their wardrobe or the way they dress or, and also the fact that they're speaking German, like there's no, you know, cues as to what their slang might be that might give you a time or, you know, sort of era of the film.
Yes, to the cavemen out there, the movie is entirely in subtitles. You know, hopefully that doesn't bother too many people in this day and age. It's 2015, get with the program. Basically, yeah, it's some very dark scenes. The mother wets the bed. You know, it's funny that there's a scene of slight comedic relief when Red Cross workers come to the house. And I tell you, the kids manage to, you know, keep the mom quiet and manage to get the Red Cross workers out of there without them suspecting all that much, which is kind of an interesting scene in itself. But, I mean, are we going to delve into the
yeah, the only way we can talk about this movie is by giving it a spoiler.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to, there's a twist to the movie. And it's unfortunately something I did not pick up on. Mike picked up on it fairly early in the film. I don't know. Sometimes I don't know. Maybe I'm a little paying attention to other parts of the movie when I should be paying attention to what's right in front of me. I don't know, but
One of the things that I want to get into before we talk about the spoiler, the big reveal, is that I kind of feel like the trailer definitely portrays the movie a lot differently than the movie actually is.
Yeah.
You know, like when you watch the trailer, I think the woman looks more horrific than she actually does in the film.
Well, the tides do turn. I think initially you are not as creeped out by the twins as you are by the mom, and you think the mom is this kind of creature, maybe, like,
yeah, like for the, especially the way the trailer puts it out there, you think that, well, you know, maybe this is like some, you know, creature, some
killed their mother
and
has taken over the mother's role.
Yes.
And there's a very odd scene, the mother gets nude quite a few times actually too in the movie. She kind of runs out into the forest and there's some weird stuff going on with contortions and things like that. Well, I personally think none of those things even really happened, which is what we're going to get to that.
I think that's shown in the trailer.
Yes.
And that's why if you just watch the trailer, you might think that, well, okay, well, this is like some, she's possessed, or there's like, you know, some creature like might have, you know, like some doppelganger
was replaced
her, you know?
But like I said, according to, you know, internet chatter, message boards, things like that, a good number of the public seem to have picked up on the spoiler very easily, while others were kind of surprised by it. I'll let you reveal it.
So if you don't want to hear this part of this, if you don't want the spoiled, just fast forward a little bit.
Exactly.
You know, to the next film, because there's not much spoilers in the next film.
No,
but,
no.
But this one, I picked up on this pretty much right in the last, like, first 10 minutes of the movie, where there's twins, right? But one of them is dead. Mm. Now, the twin Lucas is dead and Elias is still alive.
Yes.
Okay, so right off the bat, the kid named Elias is, you know, projecting his dead brother Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that keyed me off to that was, like, one of the early scenes in the movie, the mother made breakfast for them. She only made one breakfast.
I completely missed that,
and
like an idiot.
The kid, you know, Elias is like, well, what about Lucas, you know?
And she doesn't say anything? Like, is there a moment there where she doesn't address it, or she kind of...
Well, that's what put the idea in my mind, okay? And then I paid attention to every other scene where the three of them are together, and she never, ever, ever addresses Lucas at all.
No, as I was writing my notes down, because I do take notes when I watch films for the podcast, believe it or not,
mm-hmm.
I wrote down, what is the name of the other son, a little early on? Because at no point throughout the first 30 minutes of the movie is the name of the other boy even mentioned. But again, that didn't register to me that he's dead for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Another reason why I didn't think so was because during the torturing scenes, they kind of seemed like they were working in tandem to kind of get things done there.
But
they actually were not.
No,
yes,
actually,
they were not.
Lucas was giving Elias the ideas about what to do.
Yes, and telling him what to do. And Elias was the one literally carrying out all the actions. Yeah. That is true.
So in the beginning of the film, you think the mother, she's being like cruel or sadistic or something. Mm. You think that that's really what the movie's about. But the reality is, the young boy, Elias, is not able to cope with the fact that his brother died.
Yeah.
Okay, and he goes off the deep end.
Yeah.
And tries to, his brain tries to put together explanations as to what happened.
Mm.
Oh, and the thing about the mother, it turns out that she just got some plastic surgery done. She's not like some fucking creature or anything.
Right.
Like that.
Now, there is something that is completely not addressed. We don't know who the woman is in the picture.
Nope, that's never addressed.
And maybe it's kind of a cool thing. You're left to kind of figure out, is it a sister? Is it is it her twin sister that is dead?
It could be that too. That's a very good point. And that crossed my mind as well, that maybe there's a weird mirror of like her, and maybe she has a sister that died.
Yes.
And there's the two twin brothers and one of them's dead.
And there's one thing. There's a bit of an animal cruelty scene in the movie. The boys find the cat in the very beginning and they kind of hide it and nurture it because they keep it away from the mom because the mom doesn't want any pets and anything in the house. The cat kind of dies. Well, is found dead and they believe their mother to have killed it.
But I don't think the mother killed it.
No, me neither.
Because cats, when they're ready to die, they go off in some...
They hide. Yes.
And that's... They found this cat in like an abandoned building.
And there's something wrong with it.
And the kitty
wasn't happy.
And wasn't doing well. So I think that they just, you know, in their childlike innocence, were like, well, it's, you know, we'll bring this cat home and feed it and, you know. But then when the cat turns up dead, immediately they think the mother, you know, killed the cat, you know, which most likely she didn't. I don't think she did.
No, I don't think so either. I think the cat was an outside cat in a bone yard. Now that is not explained.
And that's not explained either. They find the cat in like an
this
abandoned
cavern
building.
Cavern.
Fucking
that is,
skulls around it.
That's right near the home, pretty much, is this packed with dead, well, not dead body, packed with bones and skulls. Kind of cool though.
But it doesn't go anywhere with that.
No, you know? No.
And the other thing that's not really clear, I mean, if you think just for a second, if you take a second, you think about the setting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. How did, these are questions, okay? How did Lucas die? Okay.
There's one theory of a drowning, because at the very beginning of the movie, you see the other twin kind of on a raft and he's kind of aloof. And
okay.
Isn't there a moment of calling out, I believe?
Yes, he's calling his name. Yep.
The other theory is this accident. that the mother may have been in with the boy. That's another theory.
Yeah.
But a part of me is going with this drowning.
Okay.
Where his brother didn't hear him and feels responsible. And that's why he's kind of a huge mess. He thinks it's his fault. Maybe.
So the guilt.
And that the mother literally is a famous actress and just got some plastic surgery done.
That's the thing I'm not clear about. It's like, when, why the fuck would you, like, in the midst of this tragedy, you decide it's time to get a facelift?
It's a little bit after the, it's a little bit after. We don't know exactly how much after.
Okay.
And I'm a little unclear about this dad.
Yeah, and the dad.
Is he dead or is he just, are they divorced?
I'm going with divorced.
Okay. Oh, and because that grave we see, we're thinking is the dad's, is his brother's. Is that what that is?
That's correct. Okay. I'm assuming that's what
I'm thinking that too. Yeah. Yeah, there's a bit of a scene where kind of a bit scattered, but there is a scene when the boy goes to this grave, one of the boys goes to this gravesite, and we don't really see the name, I don't think.
I'm assuming it's the young, it's Lucas's grave that we're looking at.
Yes.
But it's, none of that stuff is really clearly stated.
No.
Which is, you know, I think that's cool. That seems to be like a trend, more in these days where they don't really spell everything out to you. And it sort of takes a cue maybe from David Lynch, how he's like, doesn't really give you all the answers. Mm-hmm. And your brain has to assemble a backstory and a subplot to kind of make these things make sense to you.
Mm.
And this, what I put together was, I mean, there's the drowning of Lucas as a possibility, but not for some reason for me. And I'm once again, this may or may not even hold any water. I feel like the mother was in a car accident and mm-hmm. Lucas was killed in the car accident. And the plastic surgery was more like corrective surgery because her face got mangled in the accident.
Maybe.
And the, you know, Elias blames her for the death of his brother. And that's why all of this animosity and, you know, all this like distrust and, you know, all this other stuff and not the belief that his mother is in the house, that an imposter is there.
Now, I picked up something from the Wikipedia summary. It says, it is revealed by the mother that Lucas has died in an accident prior to the events of the movie. She tearfully explains to Elias that Lucas's death was not his fault, and she begs her son to set her free so they can both move on from the tragedy. Mind you, she's like tied to the floor. The house is burning.
Yep.
It's a little nutty at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, we don't know for certain what the hell happened.
Yeah, because I definitely acknowledge that scene, but I'm thinking maybe they were both in the car together. And mm-hmm. maybe Elias was making a commotion and the mother looked away from the road and then they got in an accident. And then, I mean, there's so many different ways you can go with that. And it's almost completely subjective how you want to put the backstory together. And that's what I think is really interesting about this movie. It's like, you know, all right, something happened. These are the things we know are true. And you tie up all the backstory yourself. You know, definitely Lucas is dead. Definitely Elias is alive. And definitely the mother is the mother. She's not some weird creature with a bandaged face because they take off the bandages and it's the mom, you know.
Now, here's the thing. Elias is so demented at the very end of the movie while the house is on fire. Like, you know, Elias continually challenges her to prove she is their mother by telling them, like, what is Lucas doing right now as the house is burning? And she's like, she can't see Lucas. So hearing that, believing that his real mother would be able to see Lucas, you know, he, like, the curtain, you know, gets even more engulfed with flames and the mother just burns to death pretty much.
Yep.
Firefighters arrive and the film ends with a ghostly shot of the mother reunited with her twin sons in a cornfield near the home. What did you think of that ending?
Well, you know, they're all dead. They all burned up in the fire. And somewhere in heaven, they're together.
Yeah, that's kind of what I got.
Yeah,
right? I mean,
and that was the biggest... That was like one of the most depressing endings to a movie I think I've ever seen. Since, like, I can't remember when.
Definitely a bit of a downer ending. The thing is, though, I think some people wanted a different type of movie. based on the trailers and based on the, you know what I'm saying? Like the information about the film, you know?
Yeah.
So I could see some people feeling a little gypped, but I did like it for what it was. And I liked the surprise, even though I didn't catch the surprise. I liked the surprise.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I definitely give it a 5 for sure. I give it a 6, you know. It's great.
Really?
Yeah, because it, for the reasons I said earlier, where it's just sort of, they present a small, very simple setting, right? In reality, it is a simple setting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they tell you what's true, okay? And they present this sort of like subjective reality that you have to kind of determine yourself. Actually, they don't tell you what's true.
No, they make you decide, but
right. they show you a setting and you have to sort of construct this like subjective reality as to what's actually going on. And then they sort of confirm or disprove what you think is going on at the end of the movie when it's revealed that, you know, one is dead and one's mm-hmm. still alive and the mom really is the mom. Because I went, you know, unfortunately, I kind of took a wild ass guess and I was like, oh, yeah, obviously, you know, he's dead. And then, but then once I went over into that realm of him being dead, of mm-hmm. Lucas being dead, all the little tags were like, oh, okay, yeah. I'm right, he's dead.
And so then you kind of realize that this is all the boy's imagination and it's the boy's like projection, you know?
Yeah.
All the craziness.
You know, but I think it was great. I enjoyed it. It was shot really well.
Yeah, it was shot on film. It was a glorious 35mm film. It's pretty cool to see an independent horror movie shot on film because, well, most independent horror movies can't afford to be shot on film. They're shot on video. But, yeah, beautiful looking movie, absolutely. And the acting was great by the two little boys and the mother. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
Okay. Why not a 5 out of 5? Like, what stopped you from
that? I don't know if it's something that I would continually go back to. Like, I've seen it, and it's like, okay, I enjoyed it. It was good. But I don't know. I think it's not a horror movie that I would watch annually, maybe. You know what I mean? Like, or, I mean, would I recommend it? Yes, see it, you know? That it garners its 4 out of 5 in that respect. It's not a perfect film, and I'm not blown away by it, so it doesn't get a 5.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right, so that's Good Night, Mommy.
Yeah, I love this movie. Even though it was a bit long, it could have been, it's 132 minutes. It could have been trimmed a little. I wasn't bored, but I could see how certain people would have been a little bored at some points of the movie. I wasn't bored. I like Westerns. I like kind of these slow, you know, I like the Western dialogue. I like the whole fucking thing. You know, I feel like it's like a lost art. When somebody does a new Western, like I feel like I get, I'm like, oh man, it's, I'm like happy to see a new Western out because so few people do them.
So you know? Bone Tomahawk came out in this year in 2015.
Yes.
And it was written and directed by S. Craig Zahler, who you believe used to write for Metal Maniacs.
I know that name in the metal journalism world. Might have to do a little more digging, but the name is extremely familiar to me.
Starring, there's an all-star cast here. Mm-hmm. You know, the main star is Kurt Russell, Patrick Wilson, Richard Jenkins, David Arquette, and Sid Haig.
And also Matthew Fox from Lost.
Oh, wait. Okay. Oh, yeah. That's
and,
right. Okay.
Sean Young, and some small roles.
Yep.
Sean Young, and even Michael Paré from Streets of Fire.
All right.
And
now, who did Michael Paré play?
He was literally in about 5 minutes of the movie. He played the guy who comes into the bar as they're all about to kind of gather up, you know, and kind of go seek out the people who've been kidnapped.
Yeah.
He has like short brown hair.
Okay.
He's in the movie. It's
Michael
it's
Paré of Streets of Fire and Eddie and the Cruiser.
Yes, he is in this movie. Unbelievable. I don't think I've heard of him in a movie in over 25 years at least. Or
they
more.
Dug him up for this one, right?
Yeah, pretty nice.
So, essentially, this is, I would say, we had a little quick discussion about this. Mm-hmm. It's really a Western.
Yes.
Straight up.
Yeah.
Really. With like, brutal, horrific elements in it.
Yes. There is a horror element, but I don't know. It doesn't, I feel like calling it a horror Western, no. It's not, I don't really like that tag for this, because to me, 85% of the movie is a Western.
I would say 100% of the movie is a Western,
you know
really.
What I mean, right.
But the reality of it is there's no, you know, undead or supernatural elements
no.
to it.
No, yes, that's true. That's
it's
true.
All really, mm-hmm. it could have actually happened.
Although we could delve into this in a moment. Some people think it horrifically portrays certain types of Indians, but hey, I mean, it's based on some truth though.
I mean, there was definitely some sensationalism.
Yes,
going on there.
Yeah, well,
you know,
yeah.
Definitely some exploitation elements.
Absolutely. You know. But this is a brand new film. The DVD Blu-ray doesn't come out till December 29th. It was just recently released onto, you know, the streaming.
All the streaming.
iTunes and Amazon. Again, not on Netflix. It had a very brief, of course, theatrical run that came out. It was around October 23rd. It was, who the hell knows where it was playing, but it's a damn shame. This movie should have been playing everywhere.
Now, you have a theory as to why this movie might be, subjugated here. Like
the
why
only thing I could think of is that it is directly corresponding with Kurt Russell's other Western, The Hateful Eight, which comes out on Christmas Day. This particular movie, I'm not sure, scheduling-wise, if it was supposed to have come out sooner or maybe later, but I feel like Quentin Tarantino's movie trumps this movie, which is an independent film, obviously. Yeah. And maybe there's a reason why there's not a lot of promotion for this movie. Maybe that is a reason. Who knows? I'm not a Hollywood guy. I can only speculate as a fan outsider that like somebody somewhere is like, do not push that Russell is in this movie. Russell's headlining another Western. Which is more of a priority.
That seems very reasonable.
Yes, it does.
That's the way Hollywood
in the
works.
Music world, Mike and I coming from the music world, I could see, say you're playing a show, right, in New Jersey at the beginning of the month, and then you have a way bigger show in New Jersey 5 weeks later.
Yeah.
And you have, say, a booking agent and a manager. What is that booking agent and manager going to tell you to promote, right?
Well, they might even tell you to cancel the first show.
Exactly. There you go. Right.
Yeah, there's all kinds of weird stuff, like with those, you know, radius clauses and stuff where it's like you can't perform, like, you know, 90 days prior to some date.
Exactly.
And that's so it's reasonable to assume.
I would imagine you know, I think Kurt Russell, if I could be wrong about this, I think he went on Stern in October and talked a little bit about this movie. I think he did. There was minimal push from this movie.
I had no idea about the movie. The bass player in my band, mm-hmm. Ben Brand, my bass player, mm-hmm. is the one who actually told me about this movie at band practice one day. He's like, you know, Bone Tomahawk, you need to see it. It's right up your alley. It's brutal. Western. Sounds like something you'd be into. And he was completely right.
You know? Oh, yeah.
The cool thing about it is that it's a slow burn, too, man.
It really is. I mean, it's like, it's a traditional Western in a lot of ways. The way it introduces the characters, the dialogue.
The dialogue is
the
very Western.
And the dialogue is aces. I mean, honestly, although it's Kurt Russell's movie and he's awesome in it, Matthew Fox kind of is ridiculously awesome in this movie.
Yeah.
And I was never a big Lost guy. And I believe Matthew Fox was on a Fox TV show. What I can't think of the name of the show he was on.
I just know him from Lost.
It kind of had a younger following in the 90s. That's where he kind of came from. My goodness. Amazing. Amazing performance. Richard Jenkins is always amazing. Patrick Wilson, also always amazing. Another little tidbit about this movie. Both Patrick Wilson and Zahn McLaren are both in this movie. Zahn McLaren, it was the main Indian in the latest season of Fargo. Oh. So this has a Fargo connection.
Okay.
That both Patrick Wilson and Zahn McLaren are in both this movie and this new season of Fargo. Although Zahn McLaren is in just minutes of this movie. He's hardly in it, but he is in it nonetheless. Movie was shot in 21 days at Paramount Ranch, a ranch in Southern California that has a Western town and like landscape areas, which is pretty amazing. I mean, there are scenes that look totally like straight, like desert, right? I mean, it looks really like ominous.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear that it was shot in like basically a set in a way.
You know, I gotta be honest with you, man. I just started getting into Fargo.
Mm.
Just like,
fantastic show.
It's great. I've only watched the first few episodes of
season
first
one.
Season one.
Oh, it's good. It's great.
Yeah, I love it. It's great.
The one thing I'll say about season two is there is a connecting thread. Even though you don't have to have had to watch season one to watch season two, actually,
yeah.
There's a nice connecting thread at the end. So.
But you know how I am. Yeah. I'll watch it from the beginning to the end.
Oh, absolutely.
In order.
yeah. Do you want to briefly describe the plot? We kind of haven't described the plot of the movie.
Yeah, we're just going off about the film, but let's talk about what it's actually about. So the movie opens up with Sid Haig and David Arquette, mm-hmm. and their characters' names are Purvis and Buddy.
Yep.
Quote unquote Buddy.
Yes.
Because it's, you know, it's kind of the name that apparently just gives.
We don't know if that's his name, right.
And there are these brigands roving the countryside. They had just murdered some travelers and taken their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then they escape into the hills because they hear horses coming, you know. And inadvertently, well, first of all, Sid Haig is killed. He's killed.
Yeah, he's very little in the film.
Mm-hmm. They wander into the country of, you know, of these Native American people, okay, and Indians, you know. Once again, you know.
They're evil Indians, though, Mike. They're
These particular brand of Indians are not your run-of-the-mill,
no.
peace-loving, you know, nature-communing, you know, peyote-smoking Indians. These are, like, dark Indians.
They refer to as troglodytes.
Troglodytes.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is not, historically, that's not, you know, that's like a troglodyte's not really
a term associated for with Indians. No.
Yeah.
Not really.
So, inadvertently, Arquette's character, Buddy, sort of knocks over like a grave mound, and they perceive that as the white man desecrating their burial ground.
Right.
So Arquette escapes, and several days later, he shows up in this town, which I believe is called New Hope.
Mm-hmm. Bright Hope.
Bright Hope. That's it. Yeah, New Hope is Star Wars, which we were talking about before we started this podcast.
Yes.
So he shows up at this bar and, you know, just hanging out. Called like with the Learned Goat, I think the bar is
learned
called.
Goat.
And you know, the assistant deputy notices that he saw this guy at the edge of town, like burying his clothes.
Richard Jenkins, yes.
Yeah. So then, you know, they call Kurt Russell's the sheriff, they call him in, and he, you know, braces up Arquette's character, and they decide that he's an undesirable, and they throw him in jail.
Yeah, there's a shootout.
He shoots him in the foot.
Shoots him in the foot.
And he's injured. They bring him to jail. So now, the doctor, Dr. O'Dwyer, what's the cat's name?
Patrick Wilson.
Patrick Wilson, right.
And his wife is the lovely Lily Simmons from Banshee. Yes.
Yeah. So he's coincidentally laid up because he has his own injury.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so he sends his wife over there to check everything out.
Who also apparently has some medical
knowledge. Background. Yes. You know, so she fixes up Buddy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You know. In the night, these band of evil Indians come in and they kidnap the actual deputy, O'Dwyer's wife,
mm-hmm.
and Arquette. Okay, so now there's three missing people.
Yeah.
So the next day, you know, they Dr. O'Dwyer, they have this big meeting at the Learned Goat, and they've come together with this. They put out this plan of action where they're going to go out and round them up.
On an aside, it's interesting little thing. We learn that Lily Simmons' character, which is Patrick Wilson's wife in the movie, has been cheating on him, and he finds this love letter from another guy. And, you know, he puts that aside because his damn wife is missing.
Yeah.
And he goes with them to, you know, on the search party to go find the wife. And also along with them on the search party is the character John Bruder, which is Matthew Fox. He's the local educated kind of guy, you know.
But also a sadistic Indian killer.
Yes,
too.
Yeah. He's apparently may come from some wealth.
Military.
He's a womanizer. He's. Yeah, and it's kind of like he feels like it's his duty to kind of go along with them because he was the one that kind of, suggested to get the doctor, I think.
Yeah.
Like he feels it's like, you know, his fault.
He's involved
somehow, right,
yeah.
That Lily Simmons is missing. Right, exactly.
Yeah. He's a complicated character.
Because
he is kind of unlikable,
mm-hmm.
but he also is kind of someone who believes in doing the right thing.
Yes.
Because he also pushes buttons a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
he's kind of a jerk. Yeah.
He's definitely kind of a jerk. He's like a, you know, sort of a cad.
But again, portrayed extremely well. Excellent acting from Matthew Fox. So the search party that goes out is made up of the sheriff, which is Kurt Russell, the backup deputy Chicory, which is Richard Jenkins, laid up with the bad leg
O'Dwyer,
Patrick Wilson, and John Bruder, played by Matthew Fox. The four of them go out to rescue the three missing people who have been kidnapped by the troglodytes.
So for a good portion of the film, it's just these guys trudging along through the out in the high plains.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, and
it's far away, basically. They know they have to go really far.
Because it's established that the scene in the beginning with Sid Haig and David Arquette, where that took place, It was 11 days later when Arquette showed up.
Mm, yeah.
They actually have a thing that says 11 days later.
Yeah, yeah. It was a far distance, right?
Yeah. So the fact of the matter, let me try to put this together now. So that the party of Indians that actually kidnapped those three people,
mm-hmm.
were only a few days ahead of them.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So they were racing off back towards where their homeland was,
mm-hmm.
11 days away.
By the time they got back there, Our heroes were not far behind,
mm-hmm.
let's just say, technically, right?
Yeah.
But they encounter a lot of problems on the way there.
Oh, yeah.
Because Patrick Wilson is, like, practically dying.
Gangrene.
There's some shady characters here and there.
There's dudes.
There's all these problems. Horses get stolen.
Yep.
And it really, I mean, the West was horrendous, let's be honest. I mean, God, you know? I mean, I romanticize it, but in the same way, I'd be like, no way in hell would I want to live back then.
No, definitely not. And this definitely captures that spirit. I mean, it's definitely along the lines of, you know, like a Sam Peckinpah movie.
Yeah.
Where everyone's kind of, well, I wouldn't say everyone's bad, clearly, in this movie.
No.
But there's a lot of, like, people are not reluctant to murder each other.
Right.
There's an ease
of violence.
Which
apparently is exactly what the Old West was like.
Yeah.
People threw down at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's one of our favorite HBO series, which takes place in the West. The hell's the name of that?
Deadwood?
Deadwood, yeah.
Yeah, that also showed the grittiness quite well. Yeah.
And there was like, I think the whole point of Deadwood is that that was a town where there was no laws. Like that was kind of the point of the film of that. The concept was that they didn't have any laws in Deadwood, so you can do whatever the hell you wanted.
Yeah. I mean, but Kurt Russell, I got to tell you, he's a perfect like sheriff, right? Like, he's such an understated actor, an underrated actor, an underutilized actor. And I feel like he's had his moments of comeuppance here and there, you know?
Yeah.
And if he's getting yet another moment of comeuppance, and if this Hateful Eight, you know, elevates him, then that would be awesome.
I've always been a huge fan of his, actually.
Me too.
Ever since I was in, the first role that I saw him in that really, really made me like him was The Thing.
Mm, yeah.
He plays MacReady.
Yep.
You know, and then Snake Plissken, mm-hmm. and then like, you know, you name it.
Big Trouble.
Big Trouble in Little China. Anytime I see Kurt Russell in a movie, I'm pretty much, all right, I'm going to at least give it a check it out. You know, when he played Mike in the Tarantino film, wasn't his name like Mike or something like that?
The
race car driver guy?
Yeah, yeah. Stuntman Mike. Yeah,
Stuntman Mike.
He's great. No, great. Awesome. Yeah.
He stole that whole, out of both of those movies, Kurt Russell's performance.
He's the one you remember, yeah.
Totally memorable, you know? And I mean, this is a little tangent, but I actually prefer Tarantino's entry into that than Planet Terror.
You know what? I kind of do too, though people like it's a little talky-talky. It's a little better. It's a little better, I think, you know? Robert Rodriguez is more horror, a little more, you know.
Definitely horror.
Gives you a little more violence and bang for your buck. But it gets really silly, more so than Tarantino's kind of silliness.
I think that, Robert Rodriguez delivered more of, like, what you might think an exploitation film should be.
Mm-hmm.
And Tarantino was, like, maybe influenced by exploitation and crafted a film that he would have made.
Yeah, and it was also, it was other than exploitation, it was also the whole Cars movie thing.
Yeah.
Like, Tulane Blacktop.
And exactly, yeah.
There was a little more to it, actually. You know, there was more to it.
Another reason why I love that movie was, like, you really get attached to those girls in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you're in Austin, Texas. This is, like, hot chicks are hanging out, drinking beer, mm-hmm. you know, like.
Yeah.
Listening to indie rock music and just, you know, being
old,
like
cool shit,
being all Austin, Texas together.
Mm, right.
And then they get fucking killed.
Yeah.
Like within the first. Like,
yeah.
They
all, no, it's like
one's legs laying in the middle of the street.
It's pretty brutal.
And I think I'm like, wow, like there was actually like you get an attachment and then like it gets ended for you. And then that movie I thought was perfectly crafted. I'm not a fan of all of his films, honestly.
No, you're not.
You know, I love certain films of his to this day. I love, but the beginning of the end for me, I thought was Inglourious Basterds. Like that one, I didn't really like that movie. And I didn't really like Django.
You didn't like Django? No.
And I probably won't like Hateful Eight.
I'm going to check it out, though.
I'm going to see it. I will always go see his movies. Always. Yeah. But I'm priming myself up to be underwhelmed by it a little bit.
Mm.
But hey, you know, but I love, you know, like Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs.
I'd have to think about my least favorite, but that would be for another time. I tell you though, this Bone Tomahawk is a far better movie than, you know, I have a feeling it'll go down as, you know what I'm saying? And I think, as a genre film and the word of mouth, everybody I know who has, seen it thinks it's insane and thinks it's like really cool and different, you know? Like I said though, I don't know the whole lack of promotion for it is kind of a bummer.
I think you're right, though. I think that the fact that Kurt Russell's starring in a Western, a violent, you know, super violent Western film. But
what does it say about today's film world when a movie with this cast basically goes straight to video? What is that?
I don't know.
That's insane. No? I mean, like, there's nowhere for, like, a small film to be seen anymore? Like, I mean,
I think that it's such stiff competition to make money.
So. Yeah.
Like it's not like the old days. Like right now we watch this thing streaming. It wasn't like we went to a movie theater and watched it. And the fact that we watch a streaming means that it's out there for free somewhere.
And as we're saying this, Tarantino's been on a tear saying he's been asked out everywhere by Star Wars in theaters. In one theater in LA that promised him his premiere basically said, no, we're going to, it's just Star Wars. Like he's getting like dissed left and right, basically.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the gamble you take, man. Yeah. It's like, you know, like going back to the music thing. It's like how many times, you know, you go on tour, you book this tour gets booked like months in advance. You show up and you find out that Danzig's playing the same night you're playing.
No, of course, exactly.
You
know,
that's just the way it goes sometimes, man. You can't fucking, what are you gonna do? Like, whine about it? This is the way it goes. So anyway, back to the plot. So our search party, they catch up to the murderous Indians. Okay.
Not without losing. Right as they kind of get there, we do lose John Bruder.
Yes.
He gets taken down first, actually.
So this is the thing. These Indians look like most like an Indian that I've never seen portrayed in any sort of Western film.
Brutal.
They're these like brutal killing machine, cannibal.
Like white painted.
They have like these like, yeah, like weird
masks and
like, masks. And they're just like, you know, sort of subhuman looking. You
yeah.
know
ferocious, I mean? Ferocious Indians. Absolutely.
Yeah. And they have these like bone jaw bones.
Yeah. All their instruments of kill are these bone items.
Sharpened
and
bones.
And bone tomahawk. Yeah. Yep. That's kind of like, it's one of the things they use to kill people. Like sharpened bones, basically. Pretty sick.
Yeah. So, you know, so Fox is dead, you know, and he kind of goes out sort of like anticlimactically too.
Well, they leave him a gun so that he can take a few out with him, because we find out that there's about 12 of them grand total, about 12 of the troglodytes. And it's funny, you get to kind of keep track of how many are killed as the numbers dwindle.
Yeah. So essentially, once they try to storm this place and they get knocked unconscious.
They get captured,
they get,
right.
You know, and then they get imprisoned in this, you know, makeshift, you know, dungeon, prison cell, you know, but they're behind bars basically. But they do discover that O'Dwyer's wife is alive and the deputy is still alive.
But Arquette has been eaten off camera. Yes.
Yeah.
And which brings us to the most vile scene of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
The killing of the deputy is just, it's Cannibal Holocaust style. It's pretty bad.
Better than Cannibal Holocaust. Well, all right.
Well, it's okay. You know what it is? You know what's a good way to describe it? It's what we all wanted to see in Green Inferno, but didn't see in Green Inferno. Is pretty much what you'll see momentarily in this movie, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is kind of like, up until this point, the movie really is a standard
Western. It's a Western, right.
There's like cowboys and Indians, basically, you know, the beautiful blonde white woman gets abducted by these like savages and gets dragged off into the woods, basically. You know, and that's like, up until now, the horrific element isn't really, you know, in play. But once again, I maintain that it's horrible and it's very brutal, but you know, I'm not trying to say that this is the way, you know, Indians did their thing back then.
I don't know how they kill people.
But this could have been true.
Could have been one of the ways they killed.
One of the ways they dispatched the white man back
then. Oh, yeah. Pretty bad.
But anyway, so that's the beginning of the brutality in this film is how they kill the deputy.
Yeah.
And that's a notable.
They basically rip him to shreds, basically.
Tear him apart. It's
like an animal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a pig, basically. Or like a cattle. I don't know. I mean, like cattle.
Yeah. So pretty soon, everyone knows the score. They're gonna eat these motherfuckers, and that's kind of like that's the threat that's looming over everyone is to be killed and consumed by these, you know, pasty, you know, savages essentially. Mm-hmm. So that's looming heavily, and they're trying to feverishly figure out a way out of this situation. You know. So where does it go from here?
Well, they find out that Lily Simmons' character has some, like, this liquid opium left.
Yes, right, for medical
In a flask, basically. And they manage to poison a few of them. And they manage to poison, well, one they kill. One is kind of like semi-unconscious, and the other one, they said, doesn't feel anything. Like, I forget, like, the whole order of what this liquid opium, whatever, does to them. But they managed to kind of get that cage open, basically.
Yeah.
And the one kind of unbelievable thing is how Patrick's character makes his way with one leg.
Yeah.
Although he has a lot of ammunition. He has a lot of ammunition on. The man basically has one leg. He makes his way up into the cave somehow.
He's actually the character that you assume is probably going to get killed right away or
yeah,
die.
Yeah, it's Patrick Wilson's character, yeah.
Yeah, because he's got like this gangrenous leg
mm-hmm.
and he's hobbling around. And then the whole time they were making their way towards the Indian encampment.
He's like almost dying.
Mm-hmm. He's hallucinating and he's like
in pain,
trailing them, you know, and... So yeah, you really, that's like the sort of irony of the situation is he's the one who actually rescues everybody.
Yes, yes. It is a little weird because I thought they had to kind of get up this tremendous thing to get to the cave. And I'm kind of not recalling how Patrick Wilson was able to do that.
The logistics of that.
Yes, that was a bit right. That's the one thing because... Yeah. At one point, we're shown Kurt Russell and Richard Jenkins' characters being literally heaved up by a rope.
Yeah, they're pulling them up.
Right.
Yep.
And we kind of don't really know how Patrick Wilson's character got up there because he's got one leg.
Maybe there's gradual incline he could have climbed up.
But he manages to basically save the day with, you know, by shooting the majority of the Indians. But the thing is, before he managed to do that, there's one thing I'm forgetting. They have this whistle embedded into their throats as their maybe distress signal for some of them. He manages to get one of them out of their throats after he's killed one of them.
That was also pretty brutal, too.
Yes, that was a pretty sick scene. Yeah, kind of forgot about that one. Yeah, I mean, there's some great violence in this movie for a Western, and it delves into the horror world when these horrible, crazy kills are happening.
Yeah,
but again, there's no supernatural element, and there's no, you know, I mean, there's a body count and there's killings. But a lot of it is done in the majority of like the Western kind of way, like shootings. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know.
There's definitely there's an exploitation element to
this. Oh, no, absolutely.
Yeah, I would say it's more of a Western exploitation film.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Because at the end when they're leaving, there's those women.
Mm-hmm.
There's these pregnant women.
Yeah, there's a weird moment there.
With these weird spikes drawn.
There are two women in the camp, apparently. They're both pregnant and they can't walk and they have tremendous spikes through their eyes so they can't see either. Very strange.
But are they part of their tribe? Is that how they meet with?
Or like, is that? Or are they women that they kind of like took in and then impregnated? Like, and maybe that's why they.
I think that might have been
right.
The fate of O'Dwyer's wife. Maybe ultimately,
maybe
that may have been what her fate, her ultimate fate, would have been. Maybe
no,
they wouldn't
no regard for
her.
Women there. No. Yeah.
But once again, that just sort of puts together this weird thing of like, you know, how does this? I mean. You know, historically, I really doubt this type of tribe existed.
Yeah, I don't know. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Like, if there's, I didn't do the super research to see if these particular type of Indians existed or where he got the idea for it. It is a cool idea, nonetheless.
Yeah, but you know, I did a little bit of research on this, and there was some reports of cannibalism.
Well, that cannibalism, I can, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
but not this extremity.
Yeah, this whole kind of, you know, strung up kind of like the way they were killed. I mean, who knows, you know? All I know is that, yeah, the Old West, boy, whew, rough times. But interesting times.
Yeah, interesting.
Make for great movies.
So Bone Tomahawk, fine film.
Yeah.
I'm also going to give this a 5.
I'm definitely giving this a 5. I would recommend it to anyone listening, actually. It's a lot of fun. Great performances. Great, you know. I mean, it's long, though. It is long. It could have been... It's over 100... It's a 132-minute film, which is pretty long. And there are some scenes that some may think are a little slow. But if you're a fan of Westerns, I don't know. I almost feel like some of that is par for the course.
If you're going to, if you catch this podcast before you leave for wherever you're going for the holidays, you know, this might be something you want to take a little break from being with the family.
Yeah, watch this.
You know, watch this. Watch this. Like, you know, if you have a, like a TV room to go off to, or your laptop, if you want to stream it on, you know, Amazon while everyone else is at the kitchen table eating oatmeal cookies, and you want to go off by yourself and lose yourself for 130 minutes, this is a good one. It'll get you out of the mix with everyone for a while.
Absolutely.
So I recommend this one too, you know, as for that purpose.
Yep. 5 out of 5, definitely. Final film of the podcast is the 2012 Christmas horror film Silent Night. We wanted to pick something to kind of go along with the Christmas theme, but I figure Silent Night, Deadly Night has been discussed a lot. Neither of us saw the new Krampus, which I have not heard any good things about at all.
You haven't heard good things about it?
I don't know. I heard really good things about it.
Yeah.
I haven't heard much good things about it. I kind of do want to see it. Didn't get the chance to see it. This movie, Silent Night, I do remember when it came out, actually, and I thought it was a remake of Silent Night, Deadly Night. If it is, it is a very loose one. It's really more of its own film altogether. Apparently, there are elements to this movie that are based on a real incident in Covina, California in 2008, which is kind of interesting.
Huh.
This movie was released theatrically November 30th, 2012, and released on DVD and Blu-ray on Anchor Bay December 4th, 2012. It's currently streaming on iTunes and Amazon. This was on Netflix at one point. It was, actually.
Really?
Okay. I do remember. It is not on it right now. Interesting thing about the director, Stephen Miller. He did this movie. Remember those Dimension Extreme films?
Yeah, definitely.
A couple of years back? Well, he did the one called Automaton Transfusion.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. That was a good one.
Yes. Yeah. And his next two movies, one is called Extraction and the other is called Marauders, both star Bruce Willis in them. So this guy's a busy guy. But anyway, getting to the cast of Silent Night, one of the other reasons I want to see this movie is because Malcolm McDowell's in it. I'll see anything with Malcolm McDowell in it. He plays Sheriff James Cooper. The beautiful Jamie King is in it as Aubrey Brattimore, one of the policemen. Jamie King is also in the My Bloody Valentine remake.
I was going to mention that. Yeah.
Yes, she is. And she is in the Mother's Day remake from 2012.
Oh, you know what?
Yes, yeah, she's great. She's actually great in all these movies. Inexplicably, Donald Loge is in this, who is from Gotham.
Donald Loge,
a million other things.
Donald Loge is a sort of sleeper actor that I really like.
Yeah.
He was also in Sons of Anarchy, too.
Yeah, what is he doing in this movie? Kind of weird, right?
He fucking auditioned for it.
I guess his manager hooked it up.
He was also in a TV show. Grounded for Life.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Which was brilliant. It took place on Staten Island. Kevin Corrigan was in it. And it was
on Fox.
Yeah, man. I used to watch that regularly. That was like back then, in my adult life, this is the first time I've ever had cable TV, right? Mm-hmm. This era of my life right now.
Right.
I used to have, this is back when you could get reception on a regular television, and I only got like two channels. And that show was one of the only shows I was able to watch.
Oh, wow.
And And that was, ever since I saw that, I've been a fan of this dude. And I thought, I like this guy a lot.
He's good on Gotham. I watch Gotham.
Yeah. I downloaded it, but I haven't seen it yet. I haven't watched any. Well, Gotham now, it's on Netflix. So.
Yes, yes. Movie actually got a lot of positive feedback in the horror world. Bloody Disgusting gave it a 3.5 out of 5. I mean, it's as far as, say if you put it in the remake category, would you say it holds up well among other remakes? I mean, to me, the only reason it's a remake is that it's a Santa.
Yeah, there's a Santa Claus in it.
And he's running amok, killing a lot of people.
And it almost has the same title as Silent Night, Deadly
Night.
Yeah,
that's the extent of it. It's actually quite a different film.
I think I wouldn't count it as a remake. I think they called it Silent Night because people may have misconstrued it as a remake and gone to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Silent Night is like a reference to Christmas, and it's a Christmas horror film, and there's like a Santa Claus in it. And I got to be honest with you, generally, I shy away from the Christmas horror genre. It's not something I really seek out, So I haven't seen a whole lot of these.
To me, the two best, to me, Black Christmas from 1974 is just a really great movie. It's the precursor to Halloween. It's a really creepy, good, solid horror movie. And the original Silent Night, Deadly Night is a one sleazy, disturbing film. I always kind of enjoyed it. It was part of the reason for wanting to check out this Silent Night, because I think going into it, I thought it might have been more of an update or a little more, have more similarities to Silent Night, Deadly Night, but it really doesn't. It was shot in Canada, and it looks kind of like it was shot in Canada.
Canadian, yeah.
It has a lot of like sleazy qualities, Mike. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. There's like straight up good nudity in there.
Tons of nudity.
Like porno. There's like a porno shoot in there. And
a pervert priest.
Pervert priest.
Like a really disturbing priest.
Really creepy pervert priest. But unlike probably what most priests are interested in, I'm assuming, to me, when I think of a pervert priest, I think of like priests and like young boys.
Yes, he was straight pervert.
He's a straight pervert priest into women. Which is a little bit
off-center. Which apparently is more of a rare fish. Yes. Let's just,
And there was some pretty good kills in there too, man, I thought.
No, absolutely. Now, it's weird. It's one of these movies that you really don't know who Santa is.
And I appreciate
the killer is.
I appreciate.
You have no clue who he is, actually, until literally the movie is over,
which
I thought was interesting.
And he really... I would like to have had him been a character that didn't just show up out of nowhere. That's my one issue. And once again, here's a big spoiler, it's like,
right.
They kind of, they have a couple of suspects that they think might be the killer Santa. It turns out to be none of them.
None of them. Exactly. They think it's Donald Loge.
They think it's
this other kind of drifter guy.
Yep.
There's a lot of there's a lot of sleaze bags in the movie.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool in that way, you know?
Totally.
And I just feel like it's definitely something you see once and you're good, right? I mean, it's a naughty holiday fun, right?
Yeah.
Maybe not that much fun to some people, but, you know, some people, the idea of Santa Claus massacring people is kind of funny and fun.
I think it's hysterical.
Yeah, man. Exactly. It's for adults, right? It's not for the kids, this movie. I mean, there was a huge outcry when Silent Night, Deadly Night came out in the early 80s. I literally remember people protesting outside of the Avenue U Theater as a child. I remember there was local footage on television. People were like disgusted by that movie. And I mean, you know, obviously we're not going to get that anymore because of the way the world is, because everyone has seen so many things that probably make something like that, you know, be like a walk in the park.
Yeah.
But for back then, that was a big deal. You know, a killer Santa and the poster of the axe in the hand going down the chimney.
Yeah.
That was just shocking shit in the 80s.
Yeah, it was like a really, you know, antisocial like trip going on with that idea, you know.
Like almost like the satanic panic of Christmas.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is totally what it was. Totally what it was.
But this one, I thought, yeah, it was fun. You know, I mean, there's like a flamethrower in it, you know.
Yeah, there's interesting kills. There's a flamethrower. There's like sickle. There's axe.
They kill
gun.
A young girl. They kill like a.
Well, yes. There's. Yeah. One of the prods. He cattle prods a little girl to death.
And impales.
Yeah.
It's like one of the first kills.
Ooh.
Second kill.
Yeah. And there is a nod to Silent Night, Deadly Night. There is an impaling on like a moose horns on the wall to the same way that. The lovely Linnea Quigley was killed in Silent Night, Deadly Night. So there's little homages there to the original. But I don't know. Again, it's not so much a remake than it's just its own kind of sleazy movie.
It's its own movie, and it's maybe exploiting the existing Silent Night, Deadly Night,
mm-hmm.
you know, and which is, that's fine with me. I mean, this is not going to. You know, it's not, like I said, this is not on the same level as like the other two films we talked about.
No.
Not even remotely.
No.
You know, but, you know, it was fun. I enjoyed it. You know, Christmas is a weird holiday for some people.
Yes.
And Malcolm McDowell's in it.
Yeah, he was, like, he kind of just chews the scenery of every movie he's in.
Yeah.
And he just kind of does his thing, you know. Although part of me questions, again, like, he's a talented guy, and a little part of me is bummed out to see him in these horrendous movies.
I just think he's coasting, man.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, fuck it. You know, he does have some great lines in the movie, though, where he's like, don't put the avocado on the burger. Keep it simple.
Yeah, he's very like, I don't know. I almost feel like he's writing these himself. Like, I don't know.
You know, and there's like a scene, you know, like a scene when our buddy Donald is incarcerated. And he goes off on Christmas and, mm-hmm. you know, as this sort of like trip that he.
Yeah, there's a lot of anti-Christmas sentiment, which obviously I guess should be, you know, should be expected in the movie to a degree.
Yeah.
About a killer Santa. But, you know, not a lot of Christmas love in this movie.
No. And if you're, you know, once again, this is one of those movies. Maybe if you're visiting your relatives, you've got a few days, you've got a couple weeks off, you're on, you know, Christmas break from college and you got some time to kill. You know, you're went out with your old buddies from high school and you get wasted.
You come home, you're home and you're drunk.
Yeah, you're home and you're drunk. You might want to put this on.
Put on Silent Night. Have some fun.
And on Christmas break.
We mentioned that you literally don't know who the killer is till the very end because they literally show you like the whole kind of process at the end of the movie.
Yep.
There was a back in the 70s, maybe, I want to say, or the early 80s, there was a guy whose wife was cheating on him.
Yes.
And he found out about it and he lost his shit and he kind of took to killing in Santa garb.
Yes.
Unfortunately, his son was kind of along for the ride.
Yeah, and he witnessed his father murdering all these
people. And Jamie King's character's father, who was a policeman, who's now retired, is the man who kills the killer Santa back in the day. And the little boy witnessed this, and thus he was the murderer the whole time. But again, we did not see this man or know of this boy or any of this throughout the entire movie.
That's kind of my big criticism is that, you know, it was like...
You know, that really, I would like to have been, there to have been some sort of rhyme or reason as to yes. who this guy was. I mean, they did make one when that first creepy guy was accused of being the Santa Claus.
He tells the story.
He tells the story as an urban legend.
Yes.
And that kind of ties it back to this.
Right.
But it kind of was like, you know, you wanted to see something, you know. I would have been more satisfied if there was an existing character who turned out
to be the killer.
Like
yeah.
there's like a Scooby-Doo moment where it's like, haha, it's so-and-so, you know?
Yeah, no, totally, totally.
But yeah, you know, I give it a 3 out of 5.
I would also give it a 3.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know if I'd watch it every year, but maybe I'd watch it again. Maybe. Since we're at the end of the year, it's December after all. Our next podcast won't be until 2016. I thought maybe we could bring up some of the movies that we really enjoyed throughout 2015. You know, our favorites, perhaps. Maybe not super official favorite list or anything. But me personally, you know, earlier in the year, late spring, early summer, we had It Follows. A movie that I really love, the movie that I still kind of think about. And I think it'll go down on a lot of people's, like, you know, best of lists as one of the best movies of the year. And The Editor from Astronaut 6, the Canadian giallo send up, which was just so much fun and so much love and care went into that movie. Even though it wasn't a straight giallo, it, in a weird way, it didn't have to be. It was just so much kind of coolness went into it, and it was so enjoyable. Totally still recommending both of those movies to everybody out there who hasn't seen them. Although I do feel like more people probably did see It Follows at this point. Definitely check out The Editor. The Editor is on DVD and Blu-ray from Shout Factory.
So, yeah, I think my top films, horror films of the year, I'm going to say is A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, the vampire movie mm-hmm. that came out, and The Editor.
Yeah.
You know, that's, once again, probably for the same reason you said, it just seems like so much care went into creating that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And it engaged me the whole way through.
Oh, totally.
And it was fun.
Yeah.
And it had a lot of, it was gory.
Uh-huh.
And if you're a fan of that genre, like, it nails it pretty perfectly, yet still is ironic.
You know what I mean? No, totally. I mean, it's funny. There's a new book out about giallo films, So Deadly, So Perverse, by Troy Haworth. And there's a second volume of it coming out. And, you know, these are written, you know, seriously. Like, you know what I'm saying? I mean, yeah. these films are taken quite seriously by a lot of people, myself included. And if it could kind of springboard any type of, you know, new blood or new attention into it, I think that'd be awesome, you know?
Yeah, totally. And A Girl Walks Home Alone, and I thought was like a really interesting take on vampire movies.
Yes, you know? It was. I liked that movie a lot.
Yeah,
I
enjoyed it. A lot of people didn't like that movie.
And yeah, I think people thought it was rather pretentious, but I enjoyed it. I mean, I even loved the cat in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, he was a great part of the movie. Yeah. I thought the music was cool. You know,
I like the way all the women looked in that movie.
Yes,
too.
good looking women. No, totally, totally. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like I paid attention, you know, to a degree to horror this year. Maybe not as much as I would have liked to. So I have a New Year's resolution to pay a little more attention, if I can, to the new horror movies coming out. And my other resolution is to watch more older horror movies. How do you like that?
I think I spent a lot of time watching older horror movies this year. You know, going back, stuff from the 70s.
Yeah, I actually just in December alone watched the Tales from the Crypt movie, the original British movie, and The Vault of Horror for the first time, and I absolutely loved every minute of both of those movies. Just something about them, you know, the atmosphere and the vibe and the music and the performances. I don't know. I just, I'm kind of gravitating to stuff like that.
There's like a couple of things I just want to mention too that I've found to be very interesting that I checked out recently and then I'm interested in looking deeper into. Mm-hmm. Along the Christmas horror theme, there's a movie called Rare Imports that I saw.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. I heard about that.
It's called Rare Imports, A Christmas Tale.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Finnish film, and that maybe next year we can... That can
sure,
be
yeah,
film.
Yeah.
But definitely check it out. It's once again, if you're afraid of subtitles, don't see it because most of it's in Finnish and there's sections that are in English, but it's like independent film, European, very clever, you know, take on Santa Claus and his elves and his helpers and, you know, sort of incorporating this kind of darker element to it.
Okay.
There's a really cute kid in the movie.
Not a sleaze fest?
No, not a sleaze fest at all.
Interesting.
It's, I guess, maybe like the way Trollhunter was, something like that.
That?
You know
what
I mean? Maybe not exactly like that, but sort of like with that sensibility, maybe. You know what I'm saying?
Hmm.
I also just recently saw He Never Died.
I didn't see that.
Which is the movie that's got a Canadian film. It's got Henry Rollins in it.
Yeah, that we could definitely discuss that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've heard nothing but good things about that.
I wasn't, for the first like 10 minutes of the film, I wasn't sure if I wanted to finish watching it.
Hmm.
But
it got better?
I soldiered on and it turned out to be really good.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. That's good.
It had a weird pacing and a weird tone in the beginning and I wasn't sure if I liked it or not, you know, but you know, I'm like, hey, what else I got to do tonight? So I finished watching it. that was another good one. And then someone told me, actually, Andrew Summers, who's a friend of mine and also a listener of the podcast, sent me something via Facebook saying that there's a Suspiria remake.
I've been hearing about that, unless it's got some new traction to it. I actually, at one point, was attached to this independent American director. And then I didn't hear much about that. I don't know. That's more of a, I'll believe it when it's the contracts have been signed. But a part of me does not want to see that. But I don't know. I would actually be more interested in seeing a remake of, say, like Deep Red than Suspiria. Okay. Don't ask me why. I feel like something like that is more tangible and maybe can be done in a way that could update the giallo genre. You know what I'm saying? Suspiria, is, to me, honestly, is up there with like The Shining and Halloween, even though Halloween was remade, and The Exorcist. And I don't know. I feel like it should just be left alone. I don't know.
I don't want to see that remake, honestly, at all.
And it's just this there's a specialness and a uniqueness to it. The music, the color, the vibe. I don't know if anyone's recapturing any of that, man. You know what I'm saying?
No, definitely not.
If you want to take Tenebrae or Deep Red, I know movies that were set in the 70s and early 80s, but I don't know. I feel like I have a little more faith in maybe some a new era of giallos than taking that supernatural classic Suspiria and doing something terrible to it.
Ditto. And yes. Then there's a sci-fi channel science fiction show called The Expanse, which I've been checking out.
It's good?
100%, dude. I see big things for this. It's going to be, I'm going to predict that this is going to be the new Battlestar Galactica.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Really interesting premise. It's got Thomas Jane in it.
Oh, okay. I like him.
You know, a bunch of other people. It's a cool storyline. It's got based on a series of books similar to Game of Thrones.
Okay. The Expanse.
Yeah. And, I just saw a poster for it on the subway and I was like, this looks interesting. So I looked it up online, premise sounded good, and I started watching it. It was really good.
Well, as far as TV goes, I jumped into Homeland. Welcome to 2011, Mike. but I like it. It's pretty freaking great. And Luther, I've always been watching Luther.
Oh, yeah,
the Luther special was on the other night. This is one of the greatest cop drama, dark shows ever. Like, such a great...
I gotta check it out.
Great stuff.
I'm sleeping on that.
Luther even has a little bit of a horror element to it sometimes. Totally. Very violent sometimes. Crazy kills and killers. And this was just a 90-minute kind of one-shot. This season four, it's not even really a season four, this fourth entry. But it was fantastic. I mean, Idris Elba is just, I don't know. I whatever he does, I like. I check him out.
That's the dude from The Wire, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, cool.
And there's the rumor mill of him being 007, but apparently that's not happening. And I don't know. Hmm. But I actually could see him as that. And
yeah,
it's because of these Luther, you know, series is the reason why I almost kind of could see him as 007 in a weird way, even though it's very different characters. He plays a cop very well, and he plays a dark kind of brooding character very well. It could be a very different kind of James Bond. And then he also kind of plays a debonair kind of guy well. So
I think it'd be cool. I'm interested in seeing that if that ever happens.
If it ever happens, yeah.
Also, I've been checking out Into the Badlands, which is like that AMC.
I haven't heard many people talking about it. Was it good?
I enjoy it. But then again, I really like martial arts films. It's not just a martial arts film. It's like, you know, there's a supernatural element to it.
Hmm.
It's very high on action. It's got cool characters. It looks great. And the fight scenes are really interesting. They're really cool fight scenes, you know, sword fights and, like, you know, axes and shit.
Well, I enjoyed the end of the mid-season Walking Dead. I'm looking forward to the return of that. Looking forward to Preacher after The Walking Dead.
Yeah, oh, man, yeah.
Looking forward to Game of Thrones, of course. Looking forward to this new show coming on HBO in February, Vinyl.
Yes.
Which is set in the 70s music industry. Looks pretty wild, some of it. And then also later in the year for HBO is something we could probably end up talking about as well. The Deuce, set in the early 80s, 42nd Street, Manhattan era. So, yeah.
Since we cover, maybe we can invite our buddy back onto this.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, have Mike McPadden back on.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. It would be interesting to see his take on some of this kind of stuff, totally.
Yeah, he'd be down for doing another episode with us.
I believe he would be. But, 2015 was a fun year. You know, it was our first kind of year, like a full year, having Necromaniacs podcast.
Yep.
And it's been great seeing it kind of grow with each one. You know, if you guys like what you're hearing, tell your friends, get the word out there. Please spread the word for us.
Yeah, share our Facebook posts, because that's primarily right as of today. That's the only presence we have on the web. However, in 2016, we will have a website.
Oh, awesome. Excellent. Yeah,
and the website basically is just going to be a place you can stream the episodes and, like, you know, go to the Facebook page.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, and maybe some blog posts about the episode. Maybe we'll put some episode notes together for each one of the, you know, the posts.
Yeah, you totally. Know.
Maybe we can actually put our star rating for all the films.
Ah, yeah, that would be fun.
So if anyone has any ideas, you know, about that, hit us up on Facebook. You know, anything you might want to see on the website.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, this is, you know, it's our labor of love. We, you know, we love movies. We don't have degrees in film studies. We're just, you know, two guys who are kind of movie obsessed. So, and, you know, sometimes we get things wrong. We'll get a name wrong, a date wrong. These things happen, you know, it's okay. And, I don't know. I have a lot of fun doing it. I have a lot of fun talking about this stuff. And, word of advice for the listeners is to dig deep, you know, check out older stuff. I know there's so much new stuff going on right now. There's just some amazing stuff from the 70s and 80s out there that is definitely waiting to be uncovered. I'm learning it all the time, you know, especially this British 70s stuff. I'm loving every minute of it.
I've been really getting into the sort of sleazy post-apocalyptic.
Uh-huh, nice. You know, like I like that genre.
The New Barbarians and, you know, Bronx Warriors.
Cool, like stuff. I remember those as a kid, man. Wow. Yeah.
They're
although
fun.
Those looked, the way they look now versus the way that they look to my young eyes are completely different. It's kind of funny.
But that kind of is like what makes them cool, though.
Yes, yes.
And it makes me, like, we keep talking about Jim Van Beber, who won. One of these episodes is going to be dedicated entirely to his catalog.
We're threatening it. It's going to happen.
But Van Beber's first, like his full length film, feature length film, Deadbeat at Dawn, is basically a, you know, belongs in that genre.
Yeah, it does.
Post-apocalyptic, future, dystopian future world, you know, like violent darkness, you know.
Yeah, we could definitely discuss that kind of stuff more. Totally. Yeah. But we wish you all the very joyous of holidays. Yes, very, very sincere, coming from the Necromaniacs crew. Yes. Yeah. And Happy New Year. And we will see you guys in 2016.
All right, guys. Happy holidays and see you next year.
Cheers. it's funny, on the poster, it says shot on glorious 35mm because it was shot on film. Because as we both know, so many movies are not shot on film anymore because they can't afford to be. So, yeah. Star Wars was. And so was the new Tarantino. All Tarantinos are all shot on film.
Yeah, well, that's
how they roll.
Yeah. You know? The Star Wars thing is going to make a bazillion, trillion, million dollars.
I'm going to see it in a couple of days.
I'll probably see it this weekend.
Yeah, I really want to see it. I've heard two completely different summations of it, so that's why I want to see it.
What?
One is that it is too much of a remake of A New Hope, and that there was no original. It's like almost it's like the same movie. That's what I read somewhere.
See, for me, that might not be a bad thing,
right?
Because I didn't see that. I didn't see any of those movies that fucking George Lucas made.
No, A New Hope is part four. He didn't make.
Wait, hold on a second.
Part 77 Star Wars. I heard it's like the 77 Star Wars remake.
Oh. A New Hope, I thought, was that those ones that came out.
No. That's Anakin Phantom Skywalker. Menace. All right. Revenge of the Sith, and I forget the other name. No. New Hope is 77.
So the first Star Wars is called A New Hope?
Yeah, they slapped that on in the 90s.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
How the fuck can they remake that? With, like, new people? Like,
yeah, see, that's this part of me. Part of it doesn't make sense. Like, how could that be? How could it be, like, the same movie as New Hope when...
It doesn't make sense, someone saying that.
Yeah.
That's just some bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. That it bears too many resemblances to it.
You know what I like? You see this meme on the internet about how saying that you've never seen Star Wars is the new I'm vegan.
Yeah.
That made me laugh.
That is pretty funny, yes.
What the fuck is wrong with people?
I know. How do you, like...
Like, taking the fun out of life, you know,
like,
what I mean?
How can you go through... How could you say be in your, say, 30s or 40s?
Yeah.
And you never saw that movie? Really? You really never saw it? I think some of these people are lying.
The fact that you care enough to say that you've never saw it makes you a fucking jerk off, if you ask me.
Yeah, and like, honestly, I haven't read any spoilers. That isn't what I just told you isn't a spoiler. It was what somebody said as an opinion.
That's I've been intentionally not investigating shit because I want to see it. I don't want people to say, oh, well, you know, fucking Luke is, you know.
Yeah, I don't know anything. Yeah. And I want to keep it that way. But let's check the volumes or whatever on mine.
You can talk a little bit.
1, 2, check, testing, 1, 2, 3.
Hey, yep, we're coming in good.
We're good?
Yeah.
Okay.
You want to do
the
honors?
This is episode 12, right?
I don't know, let's not say anything. Just say this is our Christmas holiday edition.
Christmas end of the year edition. Yes. Yeah. Okay. All right.